A result of the sequester that went into effect earlier this year, historic sites like this one are watching their budgets shrink further than they already have over past years. Here in Springfield, that means the jobs of people like Sablotny are at stake. Dale Phillips is superintendent for the Lincoln Home. He says as a direct result of the sequester, the home is losing $140,000 this fiscal year, about 5% of its overall budget. Phillips says that means the budget to run this site is down about $600,000 in 3 years. So what does that mean for operations?
What I've had to do in a nutshell is basically reduce all non-essential travel and training, reduce the bulk of my overtime, the bulk of my supply money. We've pulled back from all external activities, going out to school groups, doing any activity. I had to bring all my staff back into the park to meet the basic core mission, which is, of course, providing visitor services here for the home and for the visitor center.
Phillip says all hands are on deck, including his. He's always involved with virtually every aspect of the park, but now he too will be giving tours of the home. Luckily, though, he says, there are also volunteers to fill in the gaps.
Our volunteers logged over 6,000 hours last year. They maintain a lot of the garden, the landscaping, the visitor center. Without those volunteers, we would really be up the old creek without a paddle.
The park's busy season runs from April to November. This year, volunteers will have more duties than ever before, Phillips says. They will man the front desk, and they too will become tour guides. As Phillips and I walk to the visitor center to meet one of those volunteers, we pass a worker filling in dirt around the old-fashioned wooden walkway. Phillips says this is a good example of the variety of work that must happen to preserve the park. Everything from routine maintenance to landscaping. But this summer, Philip says he can't afford most of the extra maintenance staff he would usually hire. Andy says the amount of seasonal summer workers will be cut in half. On our walk, we also pass a group of school children.
Come on, everyone. We're walking around to the band.
The peak season here revolves in part around the buses full of children that come to see the home for field trips. Sherry Wold is working at the front desk at the visitor center when we arrive. She's one of the volunteers who Phillips says help pick up the slack as budgets shrink. Wold works 4 hours per week. She says it's a fun way to stay involved in the community after her retirement, and there's plenty for her to do.
So far, it's been nothing I can't handle.
And what kind of things are you doing here?
I give out tickets for the tour. I answer questions. I answer the phone. I direct people to different parts of the park.
Wold says she has a blast doing this. But as the site gets busier, Philip says one of her jobs may include turning visitors away.
Our tickets to go through the house are free of charge. We give them out first thing in the morning, starting every day, first come, first serve basis. There will be quite a few days this summer by the end of the day that I will not have enough tickets left to be able to accommodate. We will have to turn some of our visitors away from getting into the house.
The Lincoln Home, like all parks run by the National Park Service, is nearly completely federally funded. Donations help, but Phillips says it's tricky to solicit for those. Mostly, he just has to wait for donors to come to him. For now, the park is business as usual, and Phillips is careful to say that the house our 16th president and his family once lived in will remain in top condition.
We're holding our own. I mean, there's obviously concern, but we understand the situation, we understand the broadness of it, and we will do our best.
For now, that's something national parks around the country are striving to do as well. From the Lincoln Home on 7th Street in downtown Springfield, I'm Rachel Otwell.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL. A couple years ago, Google introduced a new product called Google Glasses. It was seen by some as kind of a curio, a thing that would belong more in a science fiction movie than in real life. Well, on Tuesday, Google began delivering its high-tech glasses, now just called Google Glass, to their first customers. NPR's Steve Henn sampled a pair.
Google Glass looks kind of like a pair of eyeglasses, except it doesn't always have lenses, and it has this tiny little screen, about the size of the end of my pinky. The screen's perched just above and to the right of my right eye. When the screen's off, it's completely transparent and out of my line of sight. When it's on, it looks, well, here's Steve Lee, who helped create it.
Imagine you're sitting on your couch at home, and you look across the living room, and you look at your TV. That's roughly the size of what the display looks like with glass, except
it feels much more intimate than that. The picture is right there, an inch from my eye. And
there is a touchpad
that runs along my temple. Glass understands some voice commands.
Okay, Glass, get directions to...
If you have a question and you want to Google an answer, Glass is perfect. It reads your texts aloud in your ear and then lets you respond.
Hi, I got your message.
Just by talking. But first and foremost, Glass is a camera that's mounted right above your eye.
So let's say I'm not very good at cooking, and I might need to call back home to Iowa to Mom to get some help. Well, I'm in the kitchen with my hands busy preparing the food, and my mom can actually see what I'm doing.
And she can coach him through dinner. Glass does almost everything a smartphone can, hands-free, but Google's not about to start selling this to the public, at least yet. Instead, just 10,000 people have won the right to pay $1,500 a pair for the gadget. Most of them earn this privilege by telling Google the creative things they'd like to do with Glass.
Yeah, I've got a list of about 30 or 40 ideas.
Dan McLaughlin picked up his yesterday. Monica Wilkinson says that for her, getting Glass feels a little bit like getting a superpower.
I've always, wanted a computer in my head, basically. So this is, the first step.
She plans to build an app to help her remember people's names at parties. Dan McLaughlin wants to build a teleprompter. I pulled his wife Lisa aside.
I have a way you could use this. So you could put him on a Google Hangout while you're relaxing and guide him through housework.
Oh my gosh.
He planted an idea.
But before I can break up the McLaughlin's marriage, Sergey Brin walks up. He's Google's co-founder. So I ask him, nicely, what a lot of people have asked me. Is Glass kind of creepy? Will this technology push us irreversibly closer to a total surveillance society?
It's definitely something we think about. I mean, one thing is there are 1,000 products on the market that are far better for surreptitious recording than this would be. I mean, there are lots of things that look like shirt buttons. And we've also tried to design the experience so that it's clear what you're doing.
To take a photo, you say, take a photo. And the little display above your eye lights up for all to see.
It's really a device that wants to be outdoors, wants to be outside, wants to be with family and friends. Yeah, I just found it so liberating.
But mostly, Sergey Brin says he's eager to see what thousands of creative people will do with it. Steve Henn, NPR News, Silicon Valley.
You're listening to WYLL AM 580, and in case you missed it, there are a few flood warnings that have been coming into effect in the last few hours. There is a flood warning now posted for the Vermilion River at Danville. It's expected to be for late Thursday night to Sunday evening that the warning will be in effect. The Vermilion was measured today at 11.8 feet this morning. That's 0.2 feet below the flood stage. The Weather Service is predicting that the river will rise above the flood stage by early Friday and will crest at 5.4 feet above the stage by Saturday, causing some moderate flooding in the area. Forecasters say that Vermilion should be back down below flood stage by Sunday afternoon. Meanwhile, the flood warning currently in effect for the Sagamon River at Monticello has been extended to late Saturday night. The river was just below the 13-foot flood stage this morning, but is forecast to rise above flood stage this afternoon. Minor flooding in that area is forecast. Right now in the Champaign-Urbana area, a flash flood watch is in effect for Thursday morning through Friday. We'll have more updates on our programs throughout the day about flooding in this area, as well as on our website at will.illinois.edu.
Today's programming is made possible by Parkland College Theater, presenting the English Music Hall musical, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, from April 24th through May 5th. Can the audience fill in the who in Charles Dickens' unfinished whodunit? More information is available at 351-2528.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 17th of April, 2013. It's the birthday of the Irish poet Brendan Kennelly, born in Ballylongford in County Kerry in 1936, author of more than 20 books of poems. Brendan Kennelly, who's said to be born in Ireland, is to inherit not only one of the most beautiful little countries in the world, but also an entire legacy of prejudices, hatreds, clichés, and an impressive supply of apparently invincible ignorance. One of his best-known works from 1983 is
Cromwell, a book-length poem about the English leader who invaded Ireland in the mid-18th century and sought to wipe out Catholicism, and also his 400-page epic poem, The Book of Judas, in which he takes up the cause of the man who betrayed Jesus, the book written from Judas's point of view. Brendan Kennelly, a professor of literature at Trinity College in Dublin, who said, "Poetry is above all a singing art of natural and magical connection because, though it is born out of one person's solitude, it has the ability to reach out and touch in a humane and warmly illuminating way the solitude, even the loneliness, of others. That is why, to me, poetry is one of the most vital treasures that humanity possesses. It is a bridge between separated souls." It's the birthday of Isak Dinesen, born in Rungsted near Copenhagen, 1885. Started writing at an early age. One of the first stories she published was about a woman who has a love affair with a ghost. She was living on a coffee plantation in Kenya. Her husband had left her. She said, "I began in the evenings to write stories, fairy tales and romances that would take my mind a long way off." The stories were published in her collection Seven Gothic Tales, wild, magical stories about such things as a group of people telling jokes, trying to survive a flood, a woman who exchanges her soul with an ape. Isak Dinesen wrote, "Truth is for tailors and shoemakers. I, on the contrary, have always held that the Lord has a penchant for masquerades." And according to legend, it was on this day in 1397 that Geoffrey Chaucer first recited the Canterbury Tales to the court of Richard II, the prologue of which opens with the famous lines, "Wander a prelay with the shore of Sota, the drocht of March hath pierced to the rot, and bothered every vine and swish liqueur of which vertu engendered is the fleur. When April with his showers sweet with fruit, the drought of March has pierced unto the root and bathed each vein with liquor that has power to generate therein and sire the flower." Here's a poem for today by Liesl Mueller, Paperwhite Narcissus. Strange how they got their name. A boy, barely a man, looked into sunlit water and saw himself so beautiful. He spent his life pursuing that treacherous reflection. There is no greater loneliness. Here they are, risen from the darkness of the pebble.